You are listening to the Roberta Glass True Crime Report, putting the true back in true crime. From New York City, Roberta Glass is now on the record.
On Monday, January 10th, eccentric millionaire Robert Durst died behind bars. Durst was convicted of the murder of his friend Susan Berman 4 months prior to his death on September 17th, 2021, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Susan Berman was a close friend of Durst and the daughter of the late Jewish mobster Davy Berman. Susan Berman was brutally murdered in her home on December 23, 2000. The prosecutors theorized in Durst's trial that Durst murdered Berman to keep her from telling law enforcement what she knew about the murder of Catherine McCormick Durst. Catherine McCormick Durst has been missing since 1981, and in 2016, she was legally declared dead. Prosecutors argued in Durst's trial that 10 months after Berman's murder, Durst was in hiding from possible prosecution for the murder of his first wife in Galveston, Texas, posing as a mute woman named Dorothy Steiner. When Durst's Texan neighbor, Morris Black, learned of Durst's true identity, Durst shot Black and cut his body into bits, disposing of them in Galveston Bay. When Black's remains were discovered, Durst successfully argued that the murder was done in an act of self-defense. With the media focusing on Durst's life, I thought this would be a good time to explore the trial that finally convicted him. Judge Mark Windham, who presided over this trial, called it, quote, the most extraordinary trial I have ever seen, unquote. And I would agree. Joining me is true crime observer Lee, who live tweeted both the Durst trial and Iowa versus Christian Rivera. Welcome, Lee.
So how did you get interested in true crime?
I was watching a documentary on Charles Manson. I think I was about 18 years old on, I think it was the GID channel or Ovation, one of those two. And I'm sitting there going like, wow, this is really interesting. So naturally I went on my phone. Mind you, we didn't have no iPhones, no iPads. So I resorted myself onto my laptop and I typed in like Charles Manson. I see like a bunch of articles, videos, and I'm like, this is really interesting, you know? And I got a gift card back in the day from Amazon and I ordered Helter Skelter, which I never read a book, but my mother read a book and she's like, oh my God, the book is so graphic. Oh my God, don't read it. You're going to wake up in the middle of the night screaming. And I decided to watch the movie. It was a docuseries on NBC or ABC in the 1970s. It's about 5 hours long and I'm sitting there going, this is like really intense, you know? This master did this to these women. And 99% of the time, these women were probably strung on crack, cocaine, LSD. Like if I remember when Leslie Van Houten, they showed like a small testimony of her when she took the stand. She goes, I didn't do this. The drugs did this. I think back in the day, in the early 2000s, it was like Zanga and there was like so many like theories after that. Kind of like the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. You have conspiracies on social media, and that's the bad thing about all this. Like, you don't want to read these conspiracies, but at the same standstill, you're like, do you believe in fan fiction, or do you believe in the reality? And that's where people use primary articles to tweet about, like myself when I did the Ghislaine Maxwell trial.
Yeah, and I'm always encouraging my audience to actually read the record. But you're right, there is a very key element in true crime where there's, I would call it true crime entertainment, where people are just making things up out of their imagination to make it more interesting. And most of these stories are weird or strange enough. I get asked a lot, and I guess I will ask you, why do you think women are primarily the audience for true crime entertainment? I'm starting to think it's because we're vulnerable physically. We're smaller than men.
That's it.
And it's some kind of way of getting control. So
yeah, go off a bit worst case scenario.
Right. And the worst case scenario is not happening. It happened to someone else. And if we read about it happening to someone else, it won't happen to us in some ways.
No, that's it.
I think that's some of it. I don't know if that's all of it. I think it's a complicated.
Unless it's not like a gender neutral issue.
It is. It's psychological. And then there's also, I think, the element that there's just great stories.
99% of the time, most serial killers are all men. That's what it is.
Right, except for the rare few. Like Eileen Warnes is the only one that comes to mind. So what made you want to start live tweeting on Twitter about the Rivera trial? First, quickly tell a little bit about Molly Tibbetts and Christian Rivera and what he was on trial for, just very quickly.
Sure. Molly Tibbetts, she was 20 years old. She went out for a run, Brooklyn, Iowa. Gifted young student, sophomore in college. She wanted to work with children. She wanted to be a teacher. She took care of children. She was a camp counselor. And one night, she just went out for a run, like most women do, walk in for her exercise. She got missing for 30 days. No one didn't hear anything. She had her iPhone present. She had her iPhone and she had her Fitbit on hand. If I remember, 30 days later, Christian Rivera led her body to authorities and he said, going, oh, her body was in a cornfield. And he knew exactly where her body was. That's the thing that really got me.
Wow.
Where he took the stand, he's like denying the fact of every allegation of her saying like, oh, I didn't put her in the cornfield. Oh, I didn't do this. Like 30 days later, he just led authorities. And if I remember, he fell asleep during an interrogation and he kept on saying, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. But when he took the stand, like I said, you'll be hysterical laughing over his key testimony of...
How does he do in cross? Probably not too well, right?
Oh, please. He had to have a translator. That's the funniest thing. He had these headphones where it was like his translator speaking to him in Spanish and everything came out of English.
Oh, so you mean it was like a woman speaking for him?
Yes.
The translator? Yes. So it was like a woman's, American woman's voice speaking for him? Oh, that's funny. So you're one of the few people that watched, I think we're one of the few people that actually watched the Durst trial.
Yes.
And yet so many people watched the Jinx.
Yes, I saw that on Twitter.
Why do you think there was so little interest in Robert Durst's trial?
I think because it was a long trial. I think it was like 50 plus days, unlike the Jinx, where you're just squeezing in, I think it was like 5 episodes, if I remember, 5 or 6. It's like you're filling in like a whole entire show. That's what it is. You're watching episode after episode to binge on. But this is like the trial where you hear firsthand testimony. You hear primary sources. You hear key witnesses talking about Durst. You hear people talk about Susan Berman. You hear people talking about the day Kathleen gone missing. You rarely heard things about Morris Black. You rarely heard like Morris Black. Oh yeah, heard of him, but not much. But like I said, when you bring up Susan Berman, oh my God, yes, I heard of her. She was from Las Vegas and her father was part of the, what was it called, Jewish Mafia, and she was a mob princess and she did this and she did that. Oh, she wrote a book and she was from Benedict Canyon where Sharon Tate was brutally murdered by the Charles Manson clan. So you're watching the Jinx and you're only squeezing in just like 4 or 5 or 6 episodes in. That's the way I saw it.
So this was an unusual trial in a lot of ways. One of the ways is because Durst was on trial for the murder of Susan Berman, who you just talked about.
Yes.
And the prosecution's theory, which is now substantiated by a verdict, was that she was killed because she was a witness in another crime. So that brought in evidence about Morris Black and Kathy McCormick Durst. So I'd never seen another trial like that where so much other evidence of murder was brought in. I'm trying to think. Maybe I'm forgetting. But no, I can't think of one.
If I remember, I think it was Lewin, or 99% sure, I'm sure about Lewin. Susan Berman called up the college that day when Kathy gone missing. Remember that?
Yes.
He was like, say, well, oh, she called the college that day disguising her voice as Kathy. And I say this all the time, mind you, there was no iPhones, there was no iPads, there was no laptops, there was none of that stuff. So if she can just come up on like a restricted number posing as Kathleen McCormick by disguising her voice, there was no auto-tune either. That's another thing a lot of people don't realize. There was no Snapchat filters where you could disguise your voice.
Right.
This is modern day technology versus past technology. Now you could just go on Snapchat and just disguise your voice. You can go on Instagram and put on filters. Same thing with Snapchat, going, oh yeah, I'm Caro, or oh, I'm him. They didn't have none of that stuff in the 80s.
True. And this was really kind of an enmeshed relationship between Susan and her friends, Linda Obst, who was a pretty famous producer, movie producer, testified that she felt that Susan Berman was in love with Durst and that Susan Berman told her that she made that call. So do you think that Durst was like some kind of surrogate father for her?
That's the thing I always wanted to know, believe it or not. When I tweeted about this, when Durst told Kathleen McCormick, going, oh, go for your abortion, go for your abortion, I said to myself, going, if they did have a kid, can you imagine this kid seeing what the hell is going on, being like, my father killed my mother in cold blood? He will be a key witness, this kid, he or she.
Right. Because do you also, we'll get to Durst's testimony, but it seemed like he had some kind of need to confess.
Yes.
Because another key witness in this, Nick Chavin.
Was Jimmy. Yes.
He told Nick Chavin it was either about Kathy Durst, his first wife, who disappeared in January 1982.
I know, 40 years. I tweet about this.
And he was just charged
before
he died with her murder. So unbelievable.
I know. When I heard that, my timeline on Twitter that afternoon and that morning was like blown up from like my followers saying, did you see this? Mimi Roach indicted, what's his name? Robert Durst on second degree. And I'm like, oh my God, justice. Holy shit. Justice after all these years. And now here I am sitting there yesterday going, oh my God, Durst had to freaking die and there's no justice for Kathleen McCormick. Come on. You survived 60 goddamn days in California for pure heart.
He survived COVID too. He couldn't show up to the sentencing because of COVID.
You survived every element in the book.
He had everything. And he was this heir with this incredible wealth.
Yeah.
The Durst have big buildings in New York. And they don't put their name on anything. So you have to know, be in the know to know what they own. But the incredible wealth. He's a little like Fredo. He was passed over for his younger brother. And he never really cared about the business. He always called in.
Yeah.
Collect. But say he just had this cheapness. And when he said, he was asked on the stand how he was treated in jail in regards to his health. And he said, I've gotten the best medical care that money can buy. Just smiling.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And before that, he was saying that he was being tortured in another jail and he wanted to get out. That's why he made a date with a prosecutor to talk about what kind of deal he could make for the death, murder of Susan Berman, which is another incredible thing. It's crazy. He was so happy he got his medical bills paid. So thrilled because he's so cheap. All I could think of is because Kathy McCormick's family put out this statement after he got convicted that they were really angry that Susan Berman, who helped Durst by making this phone call and changing the timeline completely. And this trial really makes you realize how important timelines are.
That's it.
And so it was also a terrible investigation. They never went into the home. They never looked for blood. It was the worst investigation.
And her brother said that too, believe it or not, Kathleen McCormick's brother, a few weeks ago. And he goes, it took 39 years for them to really open this case to see what really went on that day. It really took them 39 years to figure out every little detail. And the way I see it, Kathleen McCormick was in Susan Berman's shadows.
Did you find Susan Berman likable as a victim from what you heard in the trial?
How can I say it? Like, she kind of gave me like Susan Atkin vibes, to be honest with you.
That's interesting.
Like with the haircut and like the eyes. And I'm saying, going, oh my God, this woman looks kind of like Susan Atkins. Then I just like tuned out to myself saying, this woman has no ties to the Manson murderers, I could tell you right now. But then again, Manson had a shitload of followers. He had 1,000 people living in the commune, but I highly doubt that she even had ties with Manson. But she did give me that Susan Atkins vibe.
She had all these weird things with her food. She only ate two things at a certain restaurant. She would yell at the waiter if it wasn't prepared right. She was paranoid about who came to her house.
Oh, yeah.
Which came into play later with Durst and letting Durst in to, for him to murder her. And she was a trust fund woman for a long time. She but at the time of her murder, she was living on the money Durst sent her.
Yes.
And her apartment was just very sparse. It was sad what had become. Because I would think that being friends with someone like Linda Opes back in the day would have been hugely, like, a great connect.
Oh, yeah.
And here she can't get her screenplay made. No one she knows is in power. And, like, her time, you get sort of a feeling like her time had passed. But personally, and lots of people said great things about her. They had her surrogate daughter, Mila, on the stand saying fantastic things about her. And yet, I could not get over that she helped Durst. I understand loyalty. I just had a hard time connecting with her on a level. Yeah.
They kept on saying, oh, she was incredibly loyal and Durst treated her so good. If he treated her so good, why he killed her in cold blood?
Yet he wrote this cadaver note, which came up in the Jinx.
Yes.
Where he said, I can't tell the difference between the handwriting on this note and my own handwriting sample that you're showing me. And Beverly was misspelled in a particular way that he misspelled Beverly, in the address of the Beverly Hills. And yet at this trial, it started with him admitting that he wrote this note.
Yes. The funniest thing, as soon as that letter was on social media, like on Twitter, oh my God, it like blew up all over the place on like the New York Times was covering it, the LA Times, I'm saying, going, and then somebody like randomly went on Facebook.
Another really unusual thing was Deputy DA Lewin, who we've mentioned, his style, which was, speaking of differences of opinion.
Yeah.
A lot of people found him egotistical, long-winded.
Yes. Yeah, I saw that on Twitter.
There were a lot of haters.
Yes.
A lot of people, like, I found him incredibly effective. I mean, he kept Durst in cross-examination on the stand for 8 or 9 days, I believe. And that's only because Judge Windham told them, you have to stop.
Oh, yeah.
And he begged for more time. So he's known as king of the cold cases. He only tries cold cases. And from what I understand, or at least his PR is that he's never lost a case, which I believe because I think what makes him so long-winded is his fear that one juror is going to buy or hold out for the defense.
That's it.
I think the judge told him, well, on the first day, you ruined Durst's credibility. And I'm going to talk about Durst's credibility in a second. But do you think that had they done a kind of very streamlined, I counted 60 days, including the deliberations.
Yes, that's how I counted it, too, the same way as you.
So do you think it would have been just as successful a trial had they had a different kind of DA in there, leading a team of people? They really put their A team on this, and they seem to really work well as a team. Do you think it would have been just as successful, or would you think it would have been a longer, you pointed out, a 7 hours and 27 minutes.
I saw it on my phone, and that afternoon, I was in New Jersey. I'm just sitting there on my phone looking around, and I kept on posting like screenshots going, okay, we're in the 7 hour mark. And someone went on Twitter saying like, the jury has a question. I'm going, what are they asking? You know what I mean? And then as time progressed around, I think it was like 7 hours and 17 minutes around there. One of the jurors came back saying, someone got COVID. And that's when they wheeled Durst out. And I was myself going, okay, one of the jurors, someone had COVID. Okay. Then as like time progressed and I'm saying, going, oh, this is, hopefully they'll get like a verdict by Monday. If not, worst case scenario will be deadlocked jury.
You thought it was going to be deadlocked, or you thought he was really going to get away with it? Were you really shocked?
I thought he was going to get away with murder because of Morris Black and Kathleen McCormick. Then like all of a sudden, like 7 hours and like 27 minutes, I looked down at my phone going, wow, the jury clock officially stopped deliberating. Maybe they officially ended for the day, or Durst fell out of the wheelchair. I don't know. then all of a sudden, one of our hosts on Quirk TV said, going, meanwhile, in California, verdict has been reached in writer for Robert Durst. And I'm saying to myself, going, oh my God, it was like the longest hour of my life. As soon as like the woman was like, we did a jury find Robert Durst guilty of premeditated murder for Susan Berman. I'm saying, going, oh my fucking God.
So you were really shocked.
Shocked, yes.
Yeah. And so this is a guy who's really led a charmed life.
Life, that's what it is.
How does someone this dark...
Remember like when he took the stand for the first time, the first few days, he was like so coherent. He spoke about like in great detail, like, oh, I was going to open a health food store in Vermont, and this is my hippie uniform. Kathy wanted to be a pediatrician. She went to Albert Einstein College in the Bronx. And you're like, wow, this guy is very intricate in his details.
Yet he said his hearing was going. Can you talk about that a little bit?
He knew what he was talking about. Then also, like, when Lewin, like, asked him a shitload of questions, he was like, oh, I can't hear you. I don't know what you're talking about. Kathy did cocaine. He kept on emphasizing the fact that Kathy did cocaine.
That's another interesting thing, is he basically accused her of going to rehab for cocaine at the same place that she was applying to school.
That really made me laugh.
So Durst, part of his defense was that he wrote this note, but there was another note called the dig note. So they found this dig note in his country home with Kathy Durst.
Oh.
I would call her Kathy Durst since they were married at the time. In the trash can in his home, and it had a list of things to do. And it looked like he was figuring out how to get rid of the body. So one thing was dig, get a shovel off a bridge. And, the dump was another place he was going to put his wife, his beloved wife, that he says he misses so much and doesn't know what happened to her.
Yes.
But just think about this. Obviously, he didn't say that this note pertained to hiding the dead body of his wife, but he said it was about taking his boat to the dump, and the bridge was about going to Bridgehampton with his wife. It was the dumbest. It was the most tailored piece of evidence, testimony, since Oscar Pistorius, I believe. It was so ridiculous. It's like he wanted to be caught. And I got the feeling that he liked to be on trial.
That's it.
His lawyers told him not to do the jinx. He loves attention. He did the jinx.
He wanted attention. That's what I saw with him.
Need to confess and a need to get caught in some way or attention. It's like he's the older child who got passed over, kind of like Fredo, and was found with pot and all other things. We can talk about that later. But he said he was on meth doing the jinx.
Yes, I read an article.
Do you think that that is true? Or do you think that was going to be his first defense? I was on drugs and I was crazy. I don't know what I was saying when I confessed to killing them all.
He was so out there. And I remember I tweeted this saying, this Monday motivational for everyone going, Durst is from a galaxy far, far away. No wonder why.
And he was going to blame his... He brought up as reason for his odd behavior was that he was on the autism spectrum or he had Asperger's.
Yes, I heard that. Yeah, he kept on saying that too.
But they never brought in any expert.
No.
Do you think that had they searched with his money for an expert that would back that up, that that would have been convincing for the jury that he had was some kind of Asperger's and that's why his behavior is so strange, that he constantly runs when he's about to be indicted and hides?
The way I see it, he was a coward. That's what I saw when him. He was definitely a full-fledged coward. He ran from every single problem. In 2000, he fled from Westchester County to go to Galveston, Texas to avoid Jeanine Pirro. I listened to her interviews. I'm like, oh my God, this woman is very highly intelligent, and she was the DA of Westchester, and he flew all the way to Galveston to start a whole new life over as if he was in the witness protection program, and he dressed as a woman.
A mute woman named Dorothy Steiner, who he had gone to school with, I believe middle school.
Yes.
And he took tips from
a woman, a
drag queen on how to look more womanish.
A drag queen.
And he never really seemed to achieve it. But this is after Susan Berman.
Yeah.
People forget. Because part of his defense was that he was afraid of Jeanine Pirro. That was his defense.
Pirro, that's it.
Is that he thought he would be indicted for something he, quote unquote, didn't do, unquote, or whatever.
I remember, like, John Lewin asked him, going, you fled Westchester to avoid Jeanine Pirro. He goes, yeah, I did avoid her.
Yeah, it seemed like he had a very pleasant time in a California jail, in mostly the medical wing, being taken care of. Do you think jail in the medical unit gave him the attention he sought? That kind of nurturing and just special person since he was famous? He was a famous murderer?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. Coddle him like a child, you know what I mean? Like a little kid going, oh, it's okay, we'll give you an ice pop and we'll give you to get better there. We'll give you the ice for your wound and we'll take care of you here and there. Because he probably didn't, his mother passed away. Remember that? His mother passed away. Supposedly his father pushed the mother off the roof. And that was another cold case in the making where there was no DNA, there was no forensics. And all Durst remembers saying like, oh yeah, my father pushed my mother off the roof. This was his child mind. Either he saw it went on, like a visual imagination, or he saw that his mother was being pushed off the roof because she was committing suicide.
Because his brother says he could not have possibly seen from where his bedroom was. Like his story that he used to tell people to make them feel sorry for him was that he watched, his father said, let's watch mommy jump off the roof or whatever, and pointed to her and he watched it. So the other interesting thing about this is that we saw videotape testimony of some key witnesses because they were afraid they were going to either be killed by Durst in the case of Nick Chavin. So he came to court to testify in 2015 with these big bodyguards. I would have loved to have seen that. And then his brother came in this trial in person talking about how he feared for his life. And there was a note from Durst that was brought into evidence saying, my brother is putting me in the same position that Kathy put me in. So the prosecution analyzed that as a loss of control, that his brother made him feel
slighted,
like he had no control, the same way Kathy, because she was going to medical school and leading her own life. They were living apart at the time that she disappeared.
Yes.
He was dating Prudence Farrow, Mia Farrow's sister, who Dear Prudence is written about, the Beatles song is written about. So it all kind of is of one piece, this thing. But the most interesting thing, so after he killed Susan Berman, he wrote this cadaver note, because in the Jewish faith, you are to be buried very quickly. And he was concerned with that, which is so hilarious in some ways to me. You do this brutal thing, yet you're concerned about her body being buried. You're not concerned enough to kill her, but you want to make sure she's buried on time.
Write a whole note.
According to her faith. And then the other thing was that he went on to kill Morris Black right after this.
Black, yeah, like a year later, just flies out to Texas and he's like, oh, I had to go to pose as a woman and plead self-defense. Like,
and it worked. It worked.
Yeah.
With the same lawyer, Dick Dugarin, represented him in that case.
The funniest thing is, I brought this up during the Durst hearing too, going, I'm surprised they didn't bring up the part when he went to CVS.
Yes. I don't think they could bring that in, though.
But there was a video of him in
peeing
CVS
on the candy.
Galveston.
On the candy.
Yeah. And I think it was like Chestnut for Darren was saying, oh, he just had bladder surgery. Oh, really now? So let's just pee in CVS. Okay. And then somebody tweeted me saying, why was he peeing in CVS? And I'm like, maybe he has incontinence problems. I don't know. But that's thirst for you.
No, it's because he's hostile. It's because he's hostile. It's a way to expose himself. It's an act of violence, really, and aggression in the same way. It was brought up in trial that he went to Kathy's parents' house and talked about his penis around the dinner table.
Oh, yeah.
And he said he got a kick out of it because basically it's revenge. It's another form of, I don't know if you want to call it violence, but at least abuse. It's abusive to the people around him.
He was one strange person.
Very strange. He went to therapy as a child for sibling rivalry with his brother. So there was this, always this issue with his brother. You know, we heard these tapes of him referring to his brother as BM, meaning bowel movement. And he said in this tape that was played in court, "My brother don't know me like that." And there was these people that absolutely loved him. So my question is he someone who can really front well, or is he just so strange, but his money makes him attractive to people?
That's what it is. I think he was like so strange and people were just, oh, the guy has money. Maybe we can leech off him. You know what I mean? Like, then you hear people being like, oh no, Durst was charming and he knew how to take care of Susan Berman and he knew how to take care of Kathleen McCormick. If he really cared about these women, why did you kill him?
I just thought to myself, he's really a person who's meant to be in this time, living in this time. Like, before Paris Hilton, there was Robert Durst.
Yeah.
He loves being famous for being rich and accomplishing nothing. There's a scene in The Jinx where he's getting his Starbucks and talking on his cell phone. He just seems in his element. Like, this is his time on planet Earth. Cell phone, Starbucks, doing nothing, being filmed while doing it at the same time.
He was like a reality TV personality. That's what it is.
And I think he was proud of these murders.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was the only thing he accomplished. And he was asked on the stand if he would lie on the stand, and he said yes.
Yeah, I remember that.
That was amazing to me. I could see his lawyers with cue cards, like, the right answer is no. Take it back. I meant no. I couldn't hear. Blame it on your hearing. My Asperger's, whatever.
The shit that came out of his mouth was amusing sometimes. Like, the cocaine part. That's the part that really gets me. He goes, Kathy did cocaine, and that's why she wore the dark glasses. Durst, did you ever do cocaine? And you bet your man money, you'll probably deny the fact he even did coke.
Oh, it seems like he did so much of it. Whatever he wanted to do, he did. And he just could not resist disparaging the memory of his wife.
That's it.
It was so horrible, the victim blaming in this. I don't know if it's victim blaming. It's really just disparaging her character and her accomplishments. And she couldn't get anywhere into any school. My family had to help get her into medical school. Give me a break, when she's top of her class with great grades, as I remember. Am I wrong?
Yeah, she did have good grades. I remember that. He kept on, oh, she was a straight A student. She wanted to be a pediatrician. She wanted to take care of the children. And I'm like, wow, this woman seems very good-hearted, because she reminded me of clean as a whistle kind of doctor, where she will take care of people, provide the care and the support they deserve. But then again, you're listening to like Durst making her as if she's like the bad guy, like when Glofus does this to people too.
Elizabeth Loftus, the memory expert that testified in the Maxwell trial, the Cosby trial. She helped the team of Ted Bundy, Night Stalker, Tim Hennis.
She makes like the defense people the most good-hearted, kind-hearted people.
That's right.
He's such a good person, and he took care of this one, and he provided support, and he did this. And then when you mention, like, the prosecution witness, like Susan Berman, oh my God, she was a horrible person. And Kathleen McCormick, oh yeah, she did coke, and she did this. She's like the poster child slash token for the defense counsel, where she thinks, like, automatically, one to three, she's going to win. And then you're sitting there going, lady, you're feeding the jury a bunch of lies.
It was pretty much the same testimony she gave in the Maxwell trial, except in the Durst trial, she talked about the Innocence Project and how many people have been, quote-unquote, exonerated. She seems to be a true believer. She's on the Innocence Project website with a video about memory. And Ross Chait, who wrote the Witch Hunt narrative, made a great point about her theories on memory, which is she always starts out saying, well, memory isn't like a tape recorder. And he wrote, no one says it's like a tape recorder. No one thinks that. You're not debunking anything, Elizabeth Loftus. Nobody says play back the tape of your memory. Everybody says, oh, my memory's not as good as it was 10 years ago. We all recognize that memory is not like a tape recorder. There was only two witnesses for the defense, Durst and Loftus. And Lewin kept her on the stand. He started out by calling her doctor. First question. And then started calling her ma'am. He had already cross-examined her in another trial. People versus Jackson in 2012 trial, I believe. I may be off on that, but I believe that's the date. And he said the arrogance and the ego were astonishing in his closing. And never before have I seen her just... He also has a technique of going all over the place, really worked with her. And he started calling her ma'am and then pretending he forgot. And she just looked like she was ready to kill. I thought there might have been a murder in the courtroom there. She was giving him the devil eyes.
Do you remember during the Durst hearing? She goes, oh, I waved at him, but he didn't see me. And she kept on saying, like, he waved at me. And I said this during the Ghislaine Maxwell trial, too, going, I wouldn't be surprised if Ghislaine Maxwell waved at her, too.
Well, she was hugging the family members. Goodbye.
Yes. I read that on the New York Times.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. She's pen pals with Jerry Sandusky, another trial she testified at. And she's also pen pals with Hennis. Lewin asked her how many victims she's dedicated books to, none. How many victims she's pen pals with, none. She's really team defense. She's written a book called Witness for the Defense, although she claims the editor titled the book and that she's not a hired gun for the defense. The whole thing was absurd. Second only to Susan Giordano, who was this woman who wrote Durst when he was in jail. And then when he was on the run, she sent him $115,000 in cash in the bottom of suitcases covered with clothes. And she testified. She was a witness for the prosecution, which was fantastic. She looked so angry to be there. She said that she wasn't using Durst for his money, but she had gotten over $350,000 from him.
Oh, yeah. They all say that.
Her son, a car, multiple cars, but they weren't fancy cars. And that when she sent this $115,000, she didn't know that it was there. She packed the suitcases, but it was dark. She didn't know it was there. And then she switched her story to the UPS man packed the boxes or the suitcases for her. Boxes, I guess, or sent it in boxes. I don't understand how that works, but it's kind of strange. And so the prosecution alluded to that $350,000 was a low number. So why is Durst giving her money if he's so cheap?
I know.
He seemed to have killed Susan Berman because she was asking for money. More hush money because she claimed the LAPD had, why the LAPD would get in touch with her about a crime in New York, who knows, but wanted to talk to her about the disappearance of Kathy Durst, which was untrue, but it was a untruth that led to her murder, unfortunately. Why do you think he was so generous with someone like Susan Giordano?
That's a good question when you think of it. The way I see it, maybe she was vulnerable, thinking like, oh, she's not going to kill him. That's the way I saw it with her.
No, but why do you think he gave her that money? I mean, he didn't have to give her 300. Let's just use her number. Probably more.
I mean, hush money. That's what it is, to shut her up. I'm like, okay, if you're going to come clean about the witnesses, I'm going to give you this money to shut your mouth.
To Susan Giordano? Not Susan Berman. Susan Giordano.
Yeah, that's what I see. Probably gave her, like, hush money to shut her up.
So you think he told her, too, about Kathy Durst and...
Susan Berman? Yes, definitely. I think so.
And Susan Berman?
Yeah.
To Susan Giordano is what I'm talking about. Yeah, okay.
That's what I see it.
There's so many murders here.
It's like a tangled web. It's like the more and more you dig deeper and deeper into Durst, you're like... Oh my God, what the hell?
Judge Chris in the Morris Black trial that Durst got acquitted for, miraculously, she commented that she thought that what was so scary was that the way that Morris Black was dismembered, everything was found but his head, that it was so expertly done that this is someone who had killed and dismembered someone many times before. So Susan Berman wasn't dismembered.
She was shot in the back of the head, execution style.
Right, good point.
And that's definitely the coward way out.
And Kathy Durst, he hinted that she was cut up because he said, I think they're looking for body parts at one point.
Yes.
So how many people do you think he has possibly killed? Do you think that's true or do you think that he just learned from killing his wife?
I think he killed a lot more other people. I remember somebody was saying it. He had, like, ties to the Google Beach murders in Long Island, a lot of people are saying on social media. But then again, we're going back into, like, conspiracy versus real life, where people think, like, oh, yeah, he did this. And then when you try to Google up, it's, like, no such facts. Just rely on primary sources instead of going by fictional articles produced by fans.
So what do you think the best parts of this trial were before we wrap it up?
My favorite part, let's see. Oh my God, definitely the reenactment when Robert Durst versus Amaris Black, when he shot him, and they show you like the reenactment with DeGaron and
So with his defense, you showed his defense counsel, they acted it out with DeGaron, yes.
Yes, that part, oh my God, I was like full-fledged cackling when that happened. And what else? When you took the stand, like the first few days, and you're like, wow, he's really intricate. Like, he's really getting to like great detail on what happened. You're like, wow, this is really picking up. And I think by the time day 7 and day 8 came rolling around for me, I tweeted saying, he's definitely going to spill and say what he did to Kathleen McCormick because he's so coherent to what is going on.
Interesting.
And I thought Lewin was going to get up in his face and tell him, going, what'd you do to Kathy? What'd you do to her? Like, trying to like, twist words around him, say like, what'd you do to her? What'd you do to her? And he just was like stubborn.
Very stubborn. And I would agree with you. I thought Durst's testimony, particularly one part where Lewin asked him about knowing, I can't remember what it was, but he says, I don't know. I never said I knew Kathy was dead. I never said I knew where Kathy was buried. And Lewin was such a good listener, jumped on that and said, how do you know she was buried?
And he just went mute.
It's one of those Perry Mason moments that you just kind of go, goosebumpy moments.
Parts of me, it's like, I don't believe in conspiracies and like all these theoreticals online. But the way I see it, how he killed Kathleen McCormick, I just say this whole time, going, he probably shot her in the back of the head, like Susan Berman. Cut her up in little pieces like Amaris Black, and he just dumped her in like one of those remote areas on the New York and Connecticut border, and he probably didn't even know himself where he put the body after all these years. That's who I saw it. And I don't, like I said, I don't believe in conspiracies and theories, but this theory been racking in my mind for quite some time during trial.
He says the Pine Barrens came up. Do you think he pulled that from a Sopranos episode, or do you think that's really where she is?
Oh yeah. Definitely. It's all these conspiracies and theories, and you don't know what to believe. Either you say, like, okay, I believe in the fabricated lies that people spread about conspiracies, or we just go on primary sources. And the more and more you dig into primary sources, the more and more you say to yourself, going, okay, my brain hurts now.
Right.
You
know what I mean? Lee, where can people find you online? What's your Twitter handle?
Twitter, Instagram, Little Lee XXOXO.
Okay. And is the Instagram the same thing?
Yeah, same handle.
Okay, great. This has been a real pleasure. Lee, thank you so much.
Oh, no problem at all. No problem.